to lecture six. I just want to mention, Danny reminded me before the lecture started, next week for lecture seven, we'll be starting at a different time. Instead of starting 6:30 Eastern time, we'll be starting 2 hours later at 8:30. So remember, next week is 2 hours later. And when I say remember, that goes for me too. I have to remember that. I don't want to show up at 6:30 next week and then I wonder what happened to the lecture. But that's lecture seven. Now today, we're going to talk about hypothetical and disjunctive syllogism. Now, before I begin, I wanted to issue a warning. Last year, when I taught this course, the students thought this was the most difficult lecture, not the most difficult chapter in the book, but the most difficult lecture. So in case, as I'm lecturing, in case there's anything you don't understand or find difficult to follow, please let me know so we can go back and try to make it a little clearer. Because I don't like being difficult. That's only for when you're trying to do an academic paper and you try to fool the other people into thinking you know something. When you're talking to students, you're supposed to try to make things easy, or at least as easy as one can. Now, what do we mean by a hypothetical syllogism? Well, remember what we've been talking so far is what's called a categorical syllogism. What do we mean? Well, in a categorical syllogism, the premises and the conclusion are all judgments or statements that something is or isn't the case. For example, I say, all men are mortal. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. So I'm saying in the first premise, all men are mortal. That's a claim. It's saying something about all men are mortal. Similarly with Socrates is a man, the conclusion Socrates is mortal. These are all assertions. They're saying that something is true, as namely that all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, and Socrates is mortal, respectively. Now, hypothetical doesn't make an assertion. It just says, if something is true. So I say, suppose I said, if Socrates is a man, then Socrates is mortal. That isn't saying that either that Socrates is a man or that Socrates is mortal. It's just saying if Socrates is a man, then Socrates is mortal. It's just an if statement. So we can have a syllogism. Remember, syllogism is where we have two premises and a conclusion. We've gone over in the past couple lectures what's involved in a syllogism. We don't have to go over that again. So in a syllogism, we can, instead of having categorical statements, instead of having something like all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal, we can have one or both of the premises will be a hypothetical statement. Now, in what's called a pure hypothetical syllogism, both premises are hypothetical. So here's an example of a pure hypothetical syllogism. Somebody's had a question. Oh, good, that was something. Somebody just said he liked the chapter in Joyce. That's good. Yeah, I'm glad you liked the chapter in Joyce, but as long as that wasn't a question. Okay, so here's an example. If wishes are horses, beggars will ride. That doesn't say wishes are horses or that beggars will ride. It just says if wishes are horses, beggars will ride. Then the next premise is if beggars ride, donations to charity will rise. So we conclude from that, if wishes or horses, donations to charity will rise. And you can see how we get there, because first one says, if wishes or horses, beggars will rise. Second one is another statement, if beggars rise, donations to charity will rise. So we can get the conclusion from that, that if wishes or horses, donations to charity will rise, because that we know that the consequence of if beggars rise will be that donations to charity will rise, and the consequence of wishes or horses is that beggars will rise. So this is what's called, I don't think I put this down in the slides, but I should have, this is called, this is a transitive relation. So if this is, the relation here is transitive, wishes or horses, beggars will rise. Beggars rise, donations to charity will rise. So you can get from that, if wishes or horses, donations to charity will rise. Now, a mixed hypothetical syllogism has one hypothetical premise and one categorical premise. So here's an example of a mixed hypothetical syllogism. If wishes are horses, beggars will ride. Wishes are horses, therefore beggars will ride. So I see the difference from the previous one. See, in the previous one, look at this again, it has two hypotheticals, but this one has one hypothetical and one categorical one. So the conclusion here is beggars will ride, because it says, if wishes are horses, beggars will ride. So then we say wishes are horses, so then beggars will ride. Now there was a very important British philosopher who taught at Oxford, H.W.B. Joseph, who was one of the great philosophical critics. And he had a kind of funny objection to this hypothetical syllogism. This is just kind of a sidelight that just shows what I just mentioned, kind of funny. It shows what he was like. Joseph was like, he was famous for being able to criticize anything you could give him. He would come up with objections. He objected to the first premise. The first premise says, if wishes are horses, beggars will ride. What that means is something like, if beggars could just get a horse by wishing for it, then they would be able to ride since they get the horse. But what he used to do in his criticism, he would take things absolutely literally. So he said the first premise isn't right, because if wishes are horses, that would just mean that the beggar's wish would be converted into a horse, but there would be no beggar's wish, so there'd be no reason to think the beggars would ride, and there'd be no connection between the beggar and the horse. All that we'd have would be a lot more horses. It would be a way that beggars could produce a lot of horses, because the beggar's wish would be a horse, but there wouldn't be any wish there. So there's no reason to think that beggars would ride. You just have extra horses. So I thought that kind of a funny objection he had to that premise. But it's really, it's just, as I say, just kind of a sideline. Now, it turns out that a mixed hypothetical syllogism, the one where we have one hypothetical premise and one categorical premise, turns out to be much more important than the pure hypothetical syllogism. And in fact, if mathematical or symbolic logic, we're taking a course in that, the two forms of the mixed hypothetical are the most important principles of reasoning. So if you were taking mathematical logic, we really wouldn't be dealing very much with the equivalent of categorical syllogism the way we've done in the past last two lectures, of course. What we'd be dealing with is these mixed hypothetical syllogisms. Now let me see, somebody, Philip has a better wishes with Federal Reserve notes, we can. Inflation, oh, that's very good. Right, we have a lot of extra Federal Reserve notes. So, as I say, what are the two forms of the mixed hypothetical? Is the first is called modus ponens, and that's if A, then B, A, therefore B. We've seen an example on the previous slide, namely the one with wishes and horses. Let's look at it again. It says, if wishes are horses, beggars will ride. This is if A, if wishes are horses, which is A, beggars will ride. B, so we say wishes are horses, A is true, therefore beggars will ride. So that's very simple. If A, then B, A, therefore B. Now the other type, very important type of mixed hypothetical, is called modus tollens. And here the form is if A, then B, not B, therefore not A. So here's an example, again, sticking to the same, similar one, what we've used before. It says, if wishes are horses, beggars will ride. So then beggars will not ride, therefore wishes are not horses. And maybe this is a little more difficult to see in the modus ponens. The modus ponens says, if A, then B. So we say A, therefore B. And you can see right away why that's true, because one is just saying if something is the case, then something else will be the case, and we say, well, that thing is the case, so then the consequence follows. So here, the way to see this is to say, well, if beggars will not ride, then wishes aren't horses. And why is that? Because if wishes are horses, beggars will ride, and beggars will not ride. So therefore, wishes are not horses. It's pretty straightforward once you think about it. One thing to keep in mind about modus ponens and modus tollens, I put modus ponens twice, that was stupid of me, it should be modus tollens. The basic point is exactly ones we've already covered in the categorical syllogism. Remember we said this is one of the most basic things we've tried to convey in this course, is how we get to new truth. If the premises are that the syllogism are true, then the conclusion is true. So we know if the premises are true, the conclusion is true. And this is just like modus ponens, because modus ponens we're saying we have a premise, if A then B, and then we say A, and the conclusion is true. So see, it's very similar to what we said. It's exactly the same, in fact, what we said about the premise of the syllogism is true, and the conclusion is true. So this is just the same for modus ponens. Remember, also we know, suppose the conclusion of the syllogism is false, we know we reason correctly, then one of the premises is false. Suppose we say all men are immortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is immortal. So suppose we say, oh, but look, Socrates is mortal, not immortal. So we say the conclusion is false, but we've reasoned correctly, therefore at least one of the premises is false. So this is corresponds to modus tollens, because in modus tollens we say if A, then B, not B, like the conclusion being false, therefore not A. So it's the same principle that we use in the syllogism we have in modus ponens, modus tollens. Now, we want to explain a little bit more in depth what's involved in both modus ponens and modus tollens. Now, in the hypothetical proposition, let's say if A then B, what we're doing is we're identifying a sufficient condition. We're saying if A then B. What in other words, what this means is the occurrence of A is sufficient to make B true. Say, if the statement is true, then once A is true, then B is true. Let's go again now, rather tired example. If wishes are horses, beggars will ride. So this says that wishes being horses is sufficient for the truth of beggars will ride. Now here's one thing you have to be very careful about. When we say this, it's sufficient if A then B. We're not saying it's necessary for the truth of B. We're not saying that beggars will ride only if wishes are horses, because we're leaving open whether one can have B without A. Maybe beggars can ride even if wishes aren't horses. Maybe they didn't wish for horses. Somebody just comes up and gives them a horse, so then they'll be able to ride. So if they didn't wish for the horse, they'll get it anyway. So remember what we're saying: one thing is sufficient to cause another, not that it's necessary. If I suppose I say, if I'm giving a lecture, it's sufficient for condition for people to be bored. But it isn't a necessary condition. You could be bored for other things than listening to my lecture. So you see the basic difference. Sufficient means if one thing happens, it will produce the other thing, but it doesn't say you can only get this other thing through the condition you're mentioning. Now, suppose you don't realize this point or you forget about it, and a lot of people do. You can get to two fallacies, and people make these fallacies all the time, commit these fallacies all the time. Now, let's look at the first of these. Suppose we say, if wishes are horses, beggars will ride. Wishes are not horses, therefore beggars will not ride. Now you can see what I just said, what the problem is here. If we say, let's look at the hypothetical, it just says, if wishes are horses, beggars will ride. That tells us that wishes being horses is sufficient for beggars to ride. So we can't conclude that the absence of the state of affairs that wishes are horses will prevent beggars from riding. That just says something like if wishes are horses, well, beggars will ride. It doesn't tell you anything about what happens if wishes aren't horses. It leaves open whether beggars will ride. So this fallacy is called denying the antecedent, because if you have a hypothetical, if A then B, you get A therefore B, that's modus ponens. But if you say if A then B, not A therefore not B, that's denying the antecedent. It isn't the valid form of reasoning at all. Now, here's the other fallacy, which is called affirming the consequent. If wishes are horses, beggars will ride. Then we have beggars will ride, and then we conclude wishes are horses. So we can see this one also doesn't work, and why not? Because what the first premise says, again, is that if wishes are horses, beggars will ride. It doesn't say only if wishes are horses, beggars will ride. It just says wishes are horses are sufficient for beggars to ride. So suppose beggars will ride. It doesn't follow that wishes are horses, because maybe there's something else that could have brought about the beggars riding. All we know is that from the premises that wish witches or horses will bring about the beggar's delight, but maybe something else can bring this about also. So it doesn't follow that we can conclude from beggar's delight that wishes or horses. And this is called affirming the consequence. So remember, it's sort of the opposite, the fallacy, sort of the opposite from modus ponens and modus tollens. In modus ponens, we have where if A then B, A therefore B, we're affirming the antecedent. That's perfectly all right. That's modus ponens. The fallacy there is denying the antecedent. So modus ponens, the correct procedure is you affirm the antecedent, then everything's all right. But if you deny the antecedent, it's a fallacy. Modus tollens, what you're doing correctly is you deny the consequence. Say you have, if wishes or horses, beggars will ride. And suppose you say you deny the consequence, you say consequence is what comes after the if clause, the beggars will ride. If the consequence, suppose you deny it, say beggars will not ride, then you conclude wishes are not horses. Excuse me, why is that? Well, because the premise that if wishes or horses is sufficient for beggars will ride, so if beggars will not ride, then wishes are not horses. So that's a valid reasoning, denying the consequence. But affirming the consequence is a fallacy, because if you say beggars will ride, doesn't establish it wishes or horses, because for all you know, something else could have brought about the state of affairs that beggars will ride. So extremely important to not to commit either of these fallacies, and these are very common fallacies. People commit them all the time. Now, denying the antecedent and affirming the consequent make the same mistake. What they're doing is mistaking a sufficient condition for a necessary condition. What do we mean by a necessary condition? Suppose A is a necessary condition for B, then B can't occur without A. Suppose I say, I can't give this lecture unless my webcam is operating. So what I'd be saying is, my webcam's operating is a necessary condition for my giving the lecture, because I couldn't give the lecture without it. The lecture wouldn't take place if my webcam wasn't working. I could start talking, but no one would be able to hear me. I mean, people enrolled in the course and aren't within the range of my voice. So remember, a sufficient condition says something, state of affairs is enough for something else to happen. Necessary says something can't come about unless a certain condition is present. So we know how to express a sufficient condition. We just say if A, then B. If we want to say A is a sufficient condition for B, we just say if A, then B. That tells us if we have A, then B will follow. So how do we say that A is a necessary condition for B? As you, of course, say A is a necessary condition for B. The way we do that is we say if B, then A. So what that says, whenever B occurs, A occurs. B won't occur unless A does. And we can see that because we can say if B, then A. So A is then a necessary condition for B, because if the hypothetical is true, we can't have B without A. So that's how we get how we express a necessary condition. So suppose that if A, then B, and if part of this slide is dropped out there, so I'm going to have to guess what was in the rest of this. So suppose those are, and I have a pretty good idea since I wrote the slide. So suppose if A then B and if B then A are both true, then each one, A and B, are sufficient and necessary conditions of each other. That if A is a sufficient condition for B, that if you have A, then you have B, and A is also a necessary condition for B, because you have if B, then A. So both are sufficient and necessary conditions for each other, and you can do it the other way. If B, then A, then B is a sufficient condition for A, and A is a necessary condition for B. So you can have they're sufficient and necessary conditions for each other if both of these hypotheticals are true. Now here's a rather difficult question I'll give you to see if anybody gets this. Suppose you have a case like that, that you have if A then B and if B then A, so you have each is a necessary sufficient condition for the other. Is that enough to say that A and B are identical if each is a necessary and sufficient condition for the other? If anyone want to try that? It's a tough question, I'm warning you. We have any takers on that one? I'll let see, somebody's put something here. If war produces wealth in the economy, then war will improve the economy. Well, that might be, but I don't think it's a direct response to my question, but I'll have to think about that. But the answer is, my question is no. You could have something like, if a triangle is equilateral, has three equal sides, then it's equiangular, it has three equal angles, and if it's equiangular, it's equilateral. So that those would both be true, have if A then B, if B then A, but it doesn't follow that equilateral and equiangular are identical, they have two different meanings. So being jointly sufficient and necessary conditions is not sufficient for identity. But I told you this would be a tough lecture, so I just mentioned that. Now, some people have made the claim that physical science rests on the fallacy of affirming the consequent. Remember, we mentioned what affirming the consequent is, we say, if A, then B, 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 therefore A. That isn't valid because there can be other ways of getting B than A. It isn't ruled out. So why do some people say that physical science rests on affirming the consequent? There was a Calvinist philosopher named Gordon Clark who wrote a book on philosophy of science and made this claim. So the claim is this. The scientists reason this way. They say, if my theory is true, we'll observe certain results. Say they have a theory and then they'll do various experiments to test it. They say, if my theory is true, we'll observe certain results. And they say, well, we do observe these results, therefore my theory is true. So is this a good criticism? Don't scientists reason that way? They say, well, here's my theory, now we're going to test it out. It passes the test, therefore my theory is true. So I don't think that, although the scientists do that, I don't think this is a very good criticism, because unless the scientists claim that the truth of his results logically imply the theory is true, but what the scientists can say instead is the results confirm the theory. Simon could say, I made these tests, my theory said, if I made certain tests, such and such would happen. Well, it did happen. The scientists could say, well, sure, there might be some other theory that would produce the same results. Also, I can't rule that out logically, but I do think what the results do confirm my theory. I said this would happen, and it did happen, so that gives us some reason to believe that the theory is true. Let's see, somebody has a comment here. David says, Popper addressed this with confirmation theory, not even truth, only an absence of falsification. Yes, that's a quite similar point, that when Popper wanted to take for confirmation, would want extremely strong, he would, I think, want it to be that the theory could only be confirmed if the test logically imply the theory is true. So he's just using confirmation a different way from most other philosophers of science. But you're right, that's it's the same point, or at least in the same area. Now we get to another one of these complications. So remember, if you're not, if you don't understand something, be sure to make a comment, because the part we're going into now is a little, people tend to find it a little difficult, at least I do. Now, David said, another David said, I can see the theories can only falsify, not verify. Well, that depends on what you mean by verify. I mean, that Popper held the view exactly what you're saying, but I mean, the majority view of philosophers of science would say, if you have the experiment that turns out the way your theory said it would, that does give you reason to think your theory is true, not logically conclusive reason. It gives you reason to think the theory is true. Popper wouldn't accept that, but that most philosophers wouldn't agree with Popper there. It seems kind of counter to common sense. Both I had a theory, like a very crude theory. If someone runs into moving traffic, he's going to be injured, and this happens a lot of times. I think we would have good reason to think that if someone runs into moving traffic, he'll be seriously injured. Okay, so now the complication. The type of hypothetical, sometimes also called conditional statement, is called an indicative conditional. It says if A is the case, then B is the case. Take our example, if wishes are horses, beggars will ride. Said, if it turns out that wishes are horses, beggars will ride. These are all having is statements. It's a hypothetical is. Now, subjunctive or counterfactual conditional says, if A were the case, then B would be the case. So see what the difference is. Is one is saying if something is the case, and the other says if it were the case, something would happen. Suppose I said if McCain were president, then Biden would not be vice president. Well, McCain isn't president, but I'm saying if he were president, something else would be the case, namely Biden would not be vice president. I could have something like, the indicative condition would be something like, if Obama is president, then Biden is vice president. And we can use, remember, just gone over modus ponens and modus tollens, if A then B, A, therefore B's modus tollens, if A, then B, not B, therefore not A, that's modus tollens. So we can use these with subjunctive conditionals, not just indicative conditionals. And the study, as it turns out, the study of subjunctive conditionals has become a very big topic in modern logic, and they can be very tricky. And let me give you an example showing just one of these complications. An indicative conditional can be true even though a similar sounding subjunctive conditional is false. Now here's a very famous example it's been discussed a lot in modern logic. You all remember, some of you, probably most of you are too young to remember when this happened, when President Kennedy was assassinated in 1963. I remember it very well. I was in high school at the time. But the generally accepted view, people have all sorts of conspiracy theories about this, but we're not going to be concerned with that. Now, that the generally accepted view is that Lee Harvey Oswald shot Kennedy on November 22nd, 1963. So suppose we take the indicative conditional. If Oswald didn't kill Kennedy, somebody else did. And this is we know this is an indicative conditional because it's the statements are something about something, the claim about something that happened. It's not saying if something were to happen or had happened. It's saying if something did or didn't happen. So what this is saying is, suppose we take this example, if Oswald didn't kill Kennedy, somebody else did. So is that indicative conditional true? If Oswald didn't kill Kennedy, somebody else did. Well, we would think, sort of the general analysis, most people, the way most philosophers would analyze this is a true statement, because what we would hold fixed here is that Kennedy was killed. So what this is saying, well, Kennedy's killed, so if Oswald didn't do it, somebody else did. So as long as Kennedy was killed, then this is true, because somebody said, oh, well, it turns out Oswald was really not in the sixth floor of Texas School Book Depository, was having lunch on the first floor. That's one of the theories. So you can say, well, okay, even if this is true, Kennedy's dead. Somebody shot him, so it must have been somebody else. But let's look at the subjunctive condition, which sounds a bit like this indicative condition. If Oswald hadn't killed Kennedy, somebody else would have. That may well be false. So what this is saying is, suppose that we're assuming that in the actual world, Oswald killed Kennedy. And what this is saying is, if that hadn't been true, then somebody else would have. Say, if Oswald hadn't killed Kennedy, somebody else would have killed him instead. And that may be false. I mean, supposing Oswald was the only one shooting at Kennedy at the time, then it could well be false that if Oswald hadn't missed, somebody else would have killed him. So see, the indicative conditional sounds very much like the subjunctive conditional, but one is probably true and the other is probably false. So that's an indication that these are very difficult. This is very difficult philosophical terrain. So one thing that makes it difficult is how do we know when a counterfactual conditional is true? Remember, the counterfactual condition is that if something were true, then something else would happen. Like somebody has a comment. Now, David has a view on what actually happened in this fascination. Remember, what we're talking about here is just something, we're just interested in the analysis of the conditional sentences. I mean, if it turned out there were two shooters, I mean, that's an interesting, very interesting historical point, but it doesn't help us in analyzing what these conditionals mean. Okay, so the truth condition, finding out whether a counterfactual conditional is true, is often very hard to determine, and there isn't an accepted analysis of these. Now, one very influential approach is due to David Lewis, who was a philosopher at Princeton, and his analysis of counterfactuals relies on the notion called possible world. So here, what we do to understand this is we take the world as it actually is, the actual world. I'm giving the boring lecture on counterfactuals. So we imagine that this world is changed in various ways. Let's say, instead of giving a lecture where I talk about counterfactuals, I just talk about indicative conditionals. I just decided not in this possible world. I decided not to bring in all these complications about counterfactuals. So that wouldn't change the actual world very much. It would be a change, but it wouldn't be that big a change. So if you have a situation like that where made a change in the actual world, it isn't that big a change. That's called a close possible world. You can imagine, say, a possible world that isn't very close to the actual world. Like supposing while I'm lecturing, flying saucer came down and spirited me away to Mars. That isn't logically impossible, but it would be a very big change in the actual world if that were to take place. We'd have to have all sorts of things would be different. So that's not a close possible world. So in Lewis's analysis of counterfactual, a counterfactual is true if the indicative conditional that's like it in the closest possible world where the antecedent is true, then the consequent is true also. That sounds very complicated. So I'll be an example. Well, let's say if, let's take our example from the other one, if Oswald hadn't killed Kennedy, somebody else would have. So the way Lewis would take this is, well, let's look at possible worlds close to the actual world where Oswald didn't kill Kennedy. So supposing that in the close possible world to the actual world, Oswald missed, but somebody else was shooting at Kennedy and killed him, then that subjunctive conditional would be true because the indicative conditional would be true. If Oswald doesn't kill Kennedy, somebody else does. That would be the indicative conditional. So if that's true, Lewis would say the indicative conditional, it's the closest possible, in the closest possible world, if the actual world is true, then the counterfactual one is true. But supposing it turned out if Oswald didn't kill Kennedy, no one else kills Kennedy, then the subjunctive conditional is false. So as I say, don't worry if you don't get this right away. I just put this in just to show you that it's a kind of a very important topic in modern logic. Now we're going on to another thing. You know, remember in this course we're talking a lot about fallacies. So I want to give now another fallacy called the conditional fallacy. And as you might suspect, this is a fallacy involving the use of conditionals. So what the conditional fallacy is when you don't take account of all the effects of a counterfactual conditional. And I can best illustrate, tell you what this is by just giving you some examples of it, and then you'd be able to pick up what the conditional fallacy is. John Rawls, who's the most influential 20th century political philosopher, said that a plan of life is rational. Supposing you're trying to plan your life, won't be involved in a rational plan of life. Because if it's a plan that you would adopt if you were acting with full deliberative rationality. So what he's saying is, suppose it turns out, say, I'm kind of an impulsive person, so I'm not someone who actually acts with full deliberative rationality. I sometimes make very foolish decisions. I act on impulse, or I just take account something. So what Rawls is saying is, what a rational plan of life would be is what I would decide if I were acting with full deliberative rationality. So if I say to Rawls, well, but look, I'm not really that good at acting with complete rationality, he said, well, Rawls would say, well, even if you're not, a rational plan of life is what you would decide if you were acting with full rationality. So how does this commit a fallacy? Well, supposing I very frequently decide things impulsively, and this gets me into trouble. So I'm trying to decide whether I should see a therapist about this. Maybe the therapist could help me so I wouldn't act so impulsively. So according to Rawls, I should ask, would someone who was fully deliberatively rational see a therapist in this situation? But here the problem is, well, supposing I was fully rational, I wouldn't need to see a therapist. I would also know how to spell see properly. I wouldn't have the problem. So, but the conditional fallacy is, if Rawls's counterfactual condition were true, would change the original situation. So what would be rational for the person who was acting with deliberative rationality to do might not be rational for me. If I were acting with full deliberative rationality, there'd be no need for me to see a therapist. But it doesn't follow from that there's no need for me to sit with a therapist. Now, David says only infinitely slow decisions could be non-impulsive. Well, I don't think that's right. You know, impulsive would mean something like not up to the normal standards of rationality. There'd be no reason I think that the normal standards of rationality would require infinite slowness, or at least I'm not seeing why that would be the case. So here's another example of the conditional fallacy. According to Roderick Chisholm, who's another very influential philosopher, he said, it's reasonable to believe something if it would be reasonable for you to believe it if your concerns were purely intellectual. So it's a little similar to Rawls. He goes, well, supposing, say, some people believe things because they're influenced by emotion, or they're just prejudiced, so you think they believe certain things. So he said, well, what it's reasonable for you to believe is what it would be reasonable for you to believe if your concerns were purely intellectual. Now, counterexample here is, suppose you want to know whether you should believe the statements, my concerns are purely intellectual. Meaning by that, my concerns now are purely intellectual. So if I follow Chisholm's suggestion, I'll believe this is true, because if my concerns were purely intellectual, I would believe that they were. But in fact, they aren't now, so I shouldn't believe it. So you see what the fallacy is, that when you're thinking about the counterfactual conditional, you say, what would I do if this counterfactual were true? That changes what the original situation is. So it wouldn't be giving you guidance on what to do in the original situation, because things have changed so much that what you would do if your concerns were purely intellectual might very well not be relevant to what it would be reasonable for you to believe they're due now. Now, we'll now get into a few other things that Joyce discusses. Wait, maybe somebody has a comment here. And Phil says, the if from bit question. I'm not familiar with that. Maybe we could go into that in discussion as long as I'm not infinitely slow in the rest of the lecture. Okay, now, again, just a few other things Joyce goes into. So, the modus ponens syllogism, remember, if A, then B, A, there, A, therefore B, we can change to a modus tollens, and a modus tollens can be changed to a modus ponens. So, how do we do this? We'll say, if A, then B, A, therefore B, so we can change that to, if not B, then not A, A, therefore B. So what we do is we interchange the antecedent consequent of the hypothetical and then negate both. So what we're doing is if A, then B, A, therefore B. So, well, what we do is we take, instead of saying if A, then B, we reverse it. We say we have B in the antecedent, A in the consequent. So, but we negate negate both. We say if not B, then not A. And we can see why that would be true, because one says A is sufficient for B, so then we would have if not B, then not A. And how do we know that? Well, if B isn't there, then we know A isn't in there either, just because A is sufficient for B. So if we had A, then we would have B, but we don't have B, so therefore we don't have A either. So, and similarly, we can do it the other way with change modus tollens to modus ponens. We have if A, then B, not B, therefore not A. So we can change if not B, then not A, not B, therefore not A. So again, what we do is we exchange the antecedent consequent of the hypothetical and negate both. And this, if you think about it, just follows from what modus ponens and modus tollens are saying. You can see why those are true. Now, question Joyce brings up is, can we change a hypothetical syllogism to a categorical syllogism? So we have, if wishes are horses, beggars will ride. And we say, wishes are horses, beggars will ride. That's a mixed hypothetical syllogism. So it seemed like we could change the categorical syllogism. We say, the situation in which wishes are horses is a situation in which beggars will ride. That's categorical. And we say, the situation in which I put two extra wishes, wishes or horses, is a situation that's true. The situation that beggars will ride is true. So it seems like you could do it, but Joyce thinks even though you can do it, it really conceals the true relationship, because he thinks that what you're doing in a hypothetical syllogism is you're saying that beggars will ride is conditional on wishes being horses, and he thinks this is better expressed by having a hypothetical than having it categorical, that it isn't as clear, the dependence isn't as clear if you make it into a hypothetical. Now, we'll now, in the time remaining, just say a bit about disjunction, which is an or, like A or B is a disjunction. So we can take a disjunction in two ways. One is exclusive disjunction, which means A or B, but not B. both. So suppose we say all animals are either one-celled or many-celled. So it couldn't be both because animal can either has one cell or many cells. It wouldn't make sense to say, well, it has both one and many cells. But we can also have inclusive disjunction, which means A or B or both. Well, I say either all men are mortal or Obama is the president. Well, both sides of this junction, both disjuncts, as they say, are true. All men are mortal and Obama is the president. So that would be an inclusive disjunction. And in modern symbolic logic, inclusive disjunction is the standard usage. I just put in extra note here. Suppose we say a disjunction is either exclusive or inclusive. That is itself a disjunction. Which one would that be? So you say a disjunction is either exclusive or inclusive. Is that statement exclusive or inclusive? That's right, Ben said exclusive. That's right, because it can't be both. It's one or the other, but not both. Now, you can have, here's an example of a type of disjunctive syllogism. It's called modus ponendo tollens. You have an animal is either single-celled or many-celled. Protozoa are single-celled, therefore protozoa are not many-celled. So this type of inference is valid only when exclusive disjunction is used. And why is that? Because unless it's exclusive disjunction, it wouldn't follow from it being single cell that it isn't many cells also. I mean, let's look at an example here if we want. Well, but let's just make up an example. Suppose we say all men are mortal or Obama is the president. So then we say all men are mortal. So it doesn't follow that Obama is not the president, because there we have an inclusive disjunction. Both sides of the disjunction can be true. Both parts can be true. So we couldn't use this modus ponendo tollens. In fact, we could use only if it's an exclusive disjunction. Now there's another one, a lot of Latin terms here, it's called modus tollendo ponens, and this we can use whether we have an exclusive or inclusive disjunction. So we can, this one is, you can use whenever you have a disjunction. So let's take an example, say either Obama is the president or I am the president. And I say I am not the president, therefore Obama is the president. So this is valid because what the premise is saying, the disjunctive premise is saying, either one of these disjuncts is true. So then I say, well, identify one as false, so therefore the other is true, because if Obama was not the president, then both disjuncts would be false, so that the disjunctive statement would also be false, but we're saying that the disjunctive statement is true. So if one of the disjuncts is false, then the other one is true. So let's look at this one. Either Obama is the president or Mises was a Keynesian. Then we have, Mises was not a Keynesian, therefore Obama is the president. Even though it's false that Mises was a Keynesian, so then if the disjunctive statement is true, then Obama is the president. So that I think is pretty straightforward. At least it's easier than truth conditions for subjunctive conditionals. Now, the last topic I want to mention is the dilemma. A dilemma can be used in sort of an ordinary language sense, just to mean kind of a problem, like a dilemma is, I'm running out of time, but I want to say something about dilemmas. But that isn't what dilemma means in logic. Here, in logic, a dilemma has two premises. One of them is a compound hypothetical proposition. We know what a hypothetical is. If A, then B. So a compound hypothetical would be if A, then B, and then we would identify some other conditions, put them all in one hypothetical. So if this happens, such and such will happen. But if that happens, something else will happen. So we have a whole bunch of hypotheticals we haven't joined into one. And what we would have is each part of a compound hypothetical leads to an undesirable conclusion. So we say, if this happens, then if A happens, then we'll have this bad outcome. If B happens, we'll have this bad outcome. If C happens, we'll have some other bad outcome. So that's the first premise is compound hypothetical. They all have bad results. So the other premise is a disjunction that says that one of the parts of the compound hypothetical is true. So then we know we're going to get the conclusions. We're going to have this undesirable conclusion no matter what you see. So you're going to get a bad result regardless of which part of the hypothetical is true. Now, I see we have an example here. David gives, if you pay your tax, you're poor. If not, you're jailed. So then you'd say, that's very good. So then you say, well, either you pay your tax or you don't. So then you conclude either you're poor or you're jailed. So that's an excellent example of a hypothetical. Thank you for that. So that is showing what I mean. You're going to get a bad result regardless of what happens. So, but the thing is, Joyce distinguishes the various kinds of dilemma. We don't need to go into this. The basic point is that the one you're springing the dilemma on, the adversary can't avoid the undesirable conclusion. Now, if you use this to analyze a famous paradox. Suppose there's a village, in a village there's a barber who shaves all those who don't shave themselves and only those who don't shave themselves. So does the barber shave himself? Well, you might say, well, suppose you say he does shave himself, so it seems to violate one of the conditions because he shaves only those who don't shave themselves, so that would seem to show he doesn't shave himself. But if he doesn't shave himself, then it seems like he does shave himself because he shaves all those who don't shave themselves. So it seems to get a contradiction whichever way you analyze that. But it turns out this isn't, some of you probably heard of the barbershop paradox, but it isn't a genuine paradox, and we can show why if we analyze this as a dilemma. So we say, if the barber shaves himself, then he doesn't shave himself, because he shaves only those who don't shave themselves. And if the barber doesn't shave himself, then he shaves himself, because he shaves all those who don't shave himself. Then we say, well, either the barber shaves himself or he doesn't shave himself, so whatever the barber does leads to a contradiction. See, this is an example of a dilemma. So what this shows is that there couldn't be such a barber as a barber who shaves all and only those who don't shave himself, because we proved that a barber of this description couldn't exist, because it, regardless of whether he shaves himself or he doesn't, it leads to a contradiction. So that's why the barbershop paradox isn't a real paradox. We just come up with a non-existence proof for a barber of that description. Now, suppose you string a dilemma on somebody. Joyce distinguishes three ways of responding to the dilemma. And one is to take one or more of the horns, which the horns means the alternatives. You have these hypothetical propositions. If A, then you get this bad consequence. If B, then you get this other bad consequence. So one of the ways to counter dilemma is to say, well, you take one of these alternatives and say, you won't get the bad consequence that you're saying. You know, you say you're going to get this bad consequence, but in fact, you won't get it. So that you're challenging one of the horns of the dilemma. Now, another way is to say, well, the alternatives aren't the only possible ones. Remember, we have in the dilemma, we've identified the compound proposition that says, here are all these hypotheticals, all these alternatives. Then we say, well, either we have A or B or C. So another way to challenge the dilemma is to say, these aren't the only alternatives. Something else is available, and this doesn't lead to an undesirable conclusion. That's called escaping between the horns of a dilemma. And now the third alternative is constructing a counter dilemma. And what here, you take the same alternatives as the original dilemma and show that they are fatal to the original argument. And the best way to explain that is to give an actual example of this. This is a very famous example in history of logic, which is called the litigiosus puzzle. It sounds like a skin disease, but it's a logical puzzle. So in this example, which will be the last thing I'll be discussing, you're probably glad of that, is that Protagoras trained Euathlus in rhetoric, and half of his fee was payable when Euathlus won his first lawsuit. So Euathlus didn't, after he finished the course, he wasn't involved in any lawsuits and didn't pay. So see, he's supposed to pay as soon as he wins his first lawsuit, but he wasn't involved in any cases. So Protagoras sued Euathlus, and he constructed this dilemma. He said, either the court decides in my favor, it decides against me. If it decides in my favor, I win, and Euathlus has to pay. So far, so good. And he said, but if I lose, Euathlus has won the suit. By the terms of our agreement, he has to pay. Thus, whether I win or lose the suit, Euathlus has to pay. You see, this is kind of a clever argument. He's saying, we have a compound hypothetical saying, if the court decides in my favor, I win, and Euathlus has to pay. If I lose, Euathlus has to pay. So those are both undesirable consequences for Euathlus. So he said, well, either I win or I lose, the conclusion is Euathlus has to pay. So how did Euathlus counter this? He had a counter dilemma. He said, well, if I lose the suit, then by the terms of agreement, I don't have to pay. Because remember, the agreement said if he wins, he has to pay. And if a court decides in his favor, then I don't have to pay. So in either case, I don't have to pay. So he's just taking what Protagoras' argument and just coming up with a counter to it that has the opposite conclusion of one Protagoras one. So Joyce doesn't think that there's a clear solution to the puzzle, but I want to suggest, and here I'm in agreement with most people who've written on this litigiosus puzzle, that it can be solved. So the way to solve it is that neither the dilemma nor the counter dilemma can be accepted because both are relying on inconsistent criteria. We can either decide according to the terms of the agreement according to the terms of the court, but not both. If we go by the decision of the court, suppose the court decides Protagoras loses, Protagoras can't go around then say, okay, well, the court has decided I lost, but I still win because by the terms of the agreement, I'm supposed to get paid if as soon as Euaphlus wins. I mean, you couldn't apply, you can't, once the court has decided, that's it. And similarly, if you decide according to the merits of the case, suppose you say, according to the merits of the case, Euaphlus wins the case, then you couldn't say, well, then he also loses and then has to pay. You couldn't, because by the terms of the, you couldn't, let me change it. If he wins the case, that means the court decides he doesn't have to pay. You couldn't then say, well, but by the terms of the agreement, he still does have to pay. So both the dilemma and counter dilemma are applying inconsistent criteria. So to solve the puzzle, I suggest we need to consider terms of the agreement. So terms of the agreement says Euaphlus has to pay when he wins his first case, but he didn't win the case. He hasn't won a case yet, so Protagoras is suing him. He'll lose the case. Right. But once Protagoras loses, he can start a new suit, and this time he should win because Euaphlus has won a lawsuit. So what the way to solve this is, by losing the case to Euaphlus, you can bring about a situation which he'll be paid. And I just want to illustrate another example of this thing where you can bring about a condition that takes more than one step. So there's a provision in the U.S. Constitution that says the representation of a state in the Senate can't be changed without its consent. You know, each state has two senators regardless of its size. And then it says this provision, it says, can't be amended. So what would you want to do? Suppose you didn't, a lot of people didn't like that provision. They thought that larger states, states more people should have more senators. Could they get around that? And you say, well, it seems like they couldn't because the Constitution says that provision can't be amended. But you could, because what you first have to do is pass an amendment saying that this provision can be amended. And then once you did that, you could pass a further amendment changing it. So you have to do it in two steps. So I think I've gone a bit over. So I think I've given you, as I am afraid, a rather difficult lecture. So I think now we'll go to the Q&A session. And I apologize again if I've given you, made this a bit too hard. But let me know. You're free to give me negative comments in the Q&A, and I'll look in the chat also. Now, let me just go to the chat also here. Wait. Thomas asks, has it ever been considered whether a sentence diagram would be useful in reducing syllogism? Yes, I think that has been considered. Sometimes a sentence diagram would be very useful sometimes if you're trying to understand what a sentence means, so you can identify the subject and predicate and then get it into the logical form. But remember, in Joyce's kind of system of logic, all the premises are ones where you have the type A is B, or you have the copula is a form of is. So the basic thing, I think, in using diagrams would be getting the sentences into the proper logical form. And once you do that, you can go ahead and try to reduce the syllogism in the second, third, and fourth figures to the first figure. I don't think the diagram would be used directly in the reduction. It would be getting the sentence into the proper logical form as a premise. Oh, I see Thomas Sheehan, you have the same name as someone, the philosopher who writes on Heidegger, has written a number of books on Heidegger. I would assume it's not the same person, because that Thomas Sheehan wouldn't be taking a logic course from me, I would bet he wouldn't be. Karen says, did the lecture start earlier than usual? Karen, I'm sorry if you missed it. We started the same time as usual, which is 6:30 Eastern time. I know, because it's 3:30 Eastern time is 3 hours ahead of my time. You know, now, Karen, are you, you know, we changed to day in the United States. Are you outside the United States? We changed to daylight saving time, so maybe that threw off. Oh, you're in India. Yes, well, I don't know. In India, did they push the clock ahead in the past couple of weeks? If they didn't, that would kind of get the time wrong. David says, the trivium was grammar, logic, and rhetoric. Do you think the combination and the order are significant in overall learning? Now, that's a very interesting question. I'm not sure I have an answer for it. I think that medievals thought that was a good way of proceeding. We could see some basis for it. I mean, first you have to, before you can start reasoning, you have to know how what words mean and how what sentences mean, how words are arranged in sentences to produce meaningful statements. So you want to know grammar, and then logic would give you correct reasoning. And then once you have correct reasoning, then you would have the question, how do you persuade other people to accept the views that you want? So we would have rhetoric. So it would be, it would involve logic, but you would have other things as well that were involved in persuasion. So we could see that's a logical order. Now, Brand says, if you have time, please go over the significance of modus ponendo tollens and modus tollendo ponens. Again, I didn't quite understand its relevance. Well, let's go back. Let's hope I can find the right slide here. Okay, well, what we're doing here, and again, you don't have to worry about the names, you know, there's a lot of Latin names, it's just we sometimes want to reason by, in this way, we give alternatives, we say, well, either this happens or that happens, say, suppose we say, either I'm going to graduate school or I'll get a job in the glue factory. So we give certain alternatives, and then we want to say reason from those alternatives to a conclusion. And so these two ways are ways of doing that. Now, in the first one, modus ponendo tollens, we reason in this way. We say we have two alternatives. We say, like the example, an animal is either single-celled or many-celled. So say it's one of the two. And then we say, well, it's one of them. In this case, say protozoa or single-celled. So then we conclude protozoa are not many-celled. So here what we're doing is we're saying there are two alternatives, and something is one of them, therefore it's not the other one. Like, suppose you say, I'm either giving a lecture now, or I'm not giving a lecture now. So say, well, I'm giving a lecture now, therefore it's false that I'm not giving a lecture now. So that's an example of modus ponendo tollens. And the basic point to remember here is that won't work unless these alternatives are exclusive. Remember, you can have exclusive disjunctions that only one of the alternatives is can be true, but you sometimes have disjunctions where more than one alternative can be true. Suppose you say, either I'm now lecturing or Obama is president. Well, I can't say I'm lecturing, therefore Obama is not president, because both can be true at the same time. So in the modus ponendo tollen, you can only use it if it's an exclusive disjunction, only if one of them is true and not the other. Now the other one, the modus tollendo ponens, is different. Here we say, either Obama is the president or I'm not president. So then we deny one of the disjuncts. So see, look at the difference again. Modus, I went to the wrong one here. Here I did not, in the other one, I affirmed one. I said, animals are either one-celled or many-celled. And I said, protozoa are one-celled. So I concluded protozoa are not many-celled. Here, the structure is different. I said, either Obama is president or I'm the president. Here, I denied one of the disjuncts. The other one, I affirmed one. Here, I deny one. I say, I'm not the president. So I conclude Obama is the president. So this type, the modus tollendo ponens, is valid whether the disjunction is exclusive or inclusive, because for a disjunction to be true, at least one of the disjuncts has to be true. So if I'm not the president, then Obama is the president, because otherwise the disjunction would be false. So that's the basic difference there, you see. And now if your question is, why are these relevant, why is this relevant? If you're asking why we distinguish these is because it makes a difference if you're affirming one side. If you're reading this by, well, here are the alternatives, one of the alternatives is true, therefore the other one is false, that's true only if you have an exclusive disjunction. But if you say, here are the alternatives, one of them is false, therefore the other one is true, that's true regardless of what kind of disjunction you have, because otherwise it wouldn't be a true disjunction. So do you understand there, at least, is it clearer than it was? I hope so. Oh yes, I see back on the daylight saving question. Oh yeah, that would be Karen and David, that would be why there were some problems there. I guess we should have made clearer on your website that there's daylight saving. Oh good, Brandon, that worked. Now you can explain it to me because I don't get it, but I'm glad you got it. Thank you. Okay, well, we have a little bit more time. I'm glad I didn't do this lecture for the first lecture, then everybody would have dropped out and I wouldn't have gotten any money. That wouldn't be good, would it? Could I ask, did people find this, I was worried about this lecture, did people find it too difficult, or did anyone have any comments on that? Oh, Philip said he found this lecture more clear than the others. Well, it wouldn't follow that it's not difficult. Maybe the other ones were more difficult, but I'm glad you found it clearer than the others. That's it. side. Oh, now, David said not to joke up with Latin. It's a bit off, but well, as I say, you don't have to worry about the Latin terms. Thomas said he hadn't written any books on Heidegger. Yeah, so you're not the Thomas Sheehan who has written books on Heidegger. But there actually is someone by that name who has written on Heidegger. Okay, wait, I see, oh, there's something in the chat here. Philip said, I attribute this to the pervasiveness of the hypothetical and disjunctive syllogism in contemporary rhetoric. Yes, Philip, that's a very good point. You do find these hypothetical and disjunctive syllogisms a lot. Again, that's, let's say, in mathematical logic, they would be the ones that we study much more than categorical reasoning, so you're quite right to point that out. Okay, and anyone want to give any attacks on me, objections, complaints. Let's see if anybody has anything more here. Now, Philip says, Heisenberg used a conditional fallacy in his uncertainty principle. John Wheeler referred to more generally as the it from bit question. In other words, what influence does the observer, the bit or binary information, have on the observed, the it? Yes, now, let's see, so Heisenberg was suggesting that the observation would change what's happening. So that isn't, I mean, unless you think he was wrong in what he said, I mean, that wouldn't be an example of a conditional fallacy, would just be, conditional fallacy would be saying, ignoring what the conditional fallacy would be saying, you're considering it counterfactual situation, but you're ignoring that if that counterfactual were true, then other things would change besides the ones you have in mind that would affect the truth of what you're saying. So the conditional fallacy, you're not taking account of the full effects of the situation you're considering. So let's see, the it from bit thing, I like that. Yes, Wheeler was, I think, one of the great physicists. I know that, but I'm sure you know stuff much better than I do on physics. Oh, I think we have time for another. Does anybody have anything, last question or comment? We still have about another minute. Now, remember, next week, the lecture will be starting 2 hours later than usual. Now, how is that daylight saving? I don't know. Now, Joe says if a conclusion will be contradictory, is some men the negation of all men? I'm not getting what you mean by that. Is some men, some men the negation? No, remember, if you're asking if you have a proposition with some men in it, is that inconsistent with saying all men? I can say some men are mortal. Does that imply that it's not the case that all men are mortal? No, not in the system Joyce is using. Well, okay, let's see. Let me have a look and say, see page 204 of Joyce. Well, let's see page 204 of Joyce. I have it right here. Let me see. Let me just have a quick look here. Oh, yeah, so Joyce, here's what Joyce is saying. He says, he's giving this example of modus tollens. He says, if all men were actuated by the highest motives, the sanction of punishment would not be necessary. So then he's denying that. He says, denying the consequence, the sanction of punishment is not unnecessary. So make that a little simpler. He says, well, if everyone had the highest motives, you wouldn't need punishment. Then he says, you do need punishment. So he says, well, what follows from that? You know, you negated denied the consequence. So then the antecedent is false. So what is the antecedent? All men are actuated by the highest motives. So that's false to say all men are actuated by the highest motive. So if that's false, that means at least one man isn't actuated by the highest motive. But you can't conclude no men are, because if you deny, in other words, what he's saying is, if you deny that all, if you say it's false that all men have the highest motive, it's false if there's one man who doesn't. So you can't conclude no one has the highest motives from knowing that the statement is false. All you can conclude is at least one doesn't. So is that does that make it a little easier to follow? Yeah, that's right. See, the conclusion, in other words, the conclusion will not be, the contrary would be, no man is actuated by the highest motives. But the contradiction is, some man is not actuated by the highest motives. Dave said, I'm glad, okay, Dave says, he's glad I didn't scare off a customer in day one. What's meant, like meant to happen, will happen. Well, as long as people stay in my course. I wish people would enroll for my next course, which is not doing very well. The conservatives one. We need to get more people in that so I can get more money. Well, I guess we're out of time now, so I want to thank everybody for coming to the lecture. And remember, we have one more lecture, which will be next week. So thanks, everybody. Thank you.